welcome to the Daily Caller Podcast. I'm Derek Hunter. This is the Daily Caller Podcast. It's December 12th, hump day. Welcome to Wednesday, ladies and gentlemen. We're almost to the weekend. Lots of stuff to get to. The big confrontation in the Oval Office is where we'll start in just a second. We're also going to talk about Time's Person of the Year. And what a ridiculous choice it was. And you've got to hear what that magazine, that rag, that birdcage liner wrote. I remember as a kid, Time magazine mattered. It doesn't anymore. It's so sad. Plus, we have some polling data on who the Democrats want to be their nominee in 2020. And all I can say is, please, God, please. So much to get to. Like I said, a reminder, if you want to enter to win the signed Brian Kilmeade books, email Derek at dailycaller.com, D-E-R-E-K at dailycaller.com, and you'll be entered. It's just that simple, as long as you let me know that that's what you want. If you don't mention it in the email, I can't enter you in the contest. I'll respond, because I always respond, but I can't enter you in the contest unless you tell me that's what you want. On a programming note, however, we're not going to announce the winners until next week, I think, because, and this is fingers crossed, knocked on wood, because whenever I do this and I announce anything ahead of time, it just gets screwed up and it ends up not happening, but it's supposedly confirmed. Actually, we're going to have Brian Kilmeade in studio next Friday, but we're going to have to record it this Friday, if you follow. Not really sure when. We might run the show earlier in the week since it's the Friday before Christmas and I want a chance to get the books out to the winners. So we're supposed to get some more copies. So there could be even more winners than just the two that I mentioned earlier. So keep on entering, keep on trucking, keep on telling a friend. Please spread the word about the show because this show doesn't happen if you don't listen. So, yeah, that's kind of exciting. I won't get into how I know Brian Kilmeade, but anyway, let's get to the news of the day. It was a hell of a showdown. It was amazing yesterday. The President of the United States invited the Democratic leaders from Congress over to the White House. House Minority Leader until, well, probably about 3 weeks from now, and then she gets the Speaker's gavel back, likely. Nancy Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader, who's going to stay Minority Leader, thank God, Chuck Schumer, came to the White House to discuss the looming government shutdown. The media is hyping this thing to no end about the shutdown, the possibility of a shutdown. But what they won't tell you is the vast majority of the government is funded. There's about 70% of the government is already funded for next year. If there is a shutdown, it'll essentially be a slowdown. It won't be a complete shutdown because most departments in the federal government already have budgets. They're funded for next year. But the fight over the border wall and border security has Democrats digging in their heels and insisting that they will not. They shall not. This shall not pass. They will not, under any circumstances, fund a border wall. To give this some perspective, what we're talking about here is $5 billion. Now, to you and me and everybody we know, $5 billion is a ton of money. We would probably not be able to blow through. I probably wouldn't be able to blow through that money if I tried. If I developed the world's biggest cocaine habit while buying antiquities and expensive paintings, you probably couldn't blow through $5 billion. But to the federal government, $5 billion is less than half of one day's spending. Keep that in mind. Less than half of one day's spending. And both parties, for the last 30 years, 40 years, 50 years, have been spending money at a ridiculous pace on all sorts of things that don't work. There are duplicate programs for just about every welfare program, multiple programs for just about every welfare program in the federal government. And the times that people have talked about we need to reform welfare and consolidate some of these things and eliminate some programs that, you know, the people are already covered by other programs, there is absolute outrage from the left. You're cutting benefits to the neediest of Americans, which is garbage. You know, if you're getting food subsidies from three different programs. You probably could get food subsidies from just one program and get rid of the bureaucracy and the bureaucrats that eat up the majority of the money in those situations and end up putting more money, more help in the hands of the people who need it. Of course, most of the people don't need it. They keep raising eligibility, but that's for another time. So anytime anybody tries to do anything that remotely saves the government any money, there's always some liberal standing in the way going, oh, this is not, you couldn't possibly, how dare, you are so heartless, you can't possibly cut this. So when they talk about we're wasting money, we're spending $5 billion and it's a waste, keep in mind that these people set money on fire routinely. Head Start is a program that costs billions of dollars. We've spent tens of billions of dollars on Head Start over its life and during the Obama administration. The Obama administration, the Department of Education, did a study that found that there is zero benefit to Head Start. We hear it all the time, and every Democrat governor and across the country and mayor in big city constantly run on, we need universal pre-K, which is essentially Head Start, but we need universal pre-K. They want it everywhere in their state and in their district or whatever. And there is zero evidence that it works. Actually, there is evidence that it doesn't work. The federal government under Barack Obama's direction did a study and found there is no benefit to Head Start. By grade three, any benefit to Head Start is gone. In kindergarten, maybe they can, you know, fill in an oval with a crayon better than a kid who hadn't been through Head Start. But by third grade, it's done. It's gone. And we spend billions of dollars on that every year. So the idea of spending $5 billion on building some of the wall, the real wall will take $20 to $25 billion, but there are certain sections that could benefit from a wall right now. The idea that we couldn't possibly, it's too much money, it's a waste of money, is absurd on its face. I'm no fan of deficit spending, but when it is necessary and important, and you have no other choice, and there is no way with the squishes and the liberals that we have in Congress that you could even save $5 billion, which would is essentially a rounding error. I think it's 1/600th of a percentage point of what the government spends. The government spends more than $4 trillion every year. $4 trillion, which is a number you can't wrap your mind around. No one can wrap, even Jeff Bezos, the richest man in the world, $150 billion in net worth, can't wrap his mind around $4 trillion. To put it in perspective, my best friend's mother once told me something that stuck with me that is the only way I've ever heard that puts this in perspective, that kind of money. And you can't do it in terms of money. You have to do it in terms of time. It is 1 million seconds is 11 days. 1 billion seconds is 32 years. 1 trillion seconds is 32,000 years. 32,000 years is 1 trillion seconds. I think 1 billion seconds is actually 33 years. So you're looking at 11 days for 1 million seconds, 33 years for 1 billion seconds. You have lived 1 million seconds. You may have lived 1 billion seconds. And all of human history hasn't come anywhere close to existing for 1 trillion seconds. Yet every year the federal government spends more than $4 trillion, which is insane. Do you get your money's worth? Do you feel like you're getting your money's worth? So the idea that we couldn't possibly, that it's such a waste, we couldn't possibly waste $5 billion. It's too precious a resource from the clowns who spend that much money is a joke on its face. Yet they make it with a straight face. Nancy Pelosi maybe can't move her face, but Chuck Schumer can move his face. So we're going to start with some of this audio. We have a bunch of the audio. I just think it's worth hearing because you hear people's priorities. What's really funny here is the White House press corps was called into the Oval Office, and there's Chuck Schumer sitting there, and there's Nancy Pelosi sitting there, there's Donald Trump, and there's Mike Pence. You wouldn't know Mike Pence was in the room if you just heard the audio. He doesn't say a peep. He's just watching this, and I think he's smiling quietly to himself, laughing. He doesn't move a whole lot either, which maybe it was a cardboard cutout. I'm not sure. Nobody poked him. But it's just kind of funny sitting. Mike Pence is sitting there going, "This is not my style." Mike Pence is one of the sort of calmest guys. He's not exactly. I've seen Mike Pence give speeches, even when he was a member of Congress. He's not a charismatic guy, shall we say, when it comes to a crowd. You wouldn't pick him out of a lineup. You wouldn't. There are some people who, when they walk into a party, they kind of light up the room and all heads turn to them and everybody kind of gravitates toward them. Mike Pence ain't that guy. I would say that's evident in this audio that I'm going to play for you, but you wouldn't know he's there unless I told you. So you can't really pick up on somebody just existing in a clip of audio. I don't think he even exhales hard, if at all. He just kind of sat there stiff. It's kind of a oh crap moment versus enjoying it. I'm not really sure which it was, but it was kind of fun to look at him while this video was going on. Anyway, we have some audio of this. The president allows, he says, you know, he does his little greeting. He talks for like 5 minutes and welcomes everybody there and lays out kind of an overview of the agenda that they're going to talk to. And then you can tell that Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer thought that the press was at that point going to be invited to leave, that this was a photo op so that the newspapers and the nightly newscasts would have B-roll and photographs to run in their stories about that the president met with Democratic leaders in the Congress today. That's not what happened. The president kept the cameras in there. It's his prerogative, kept the cameras in there. And this made Chuck and Nancy wildly uncomfortable. Wildly uncomfortable. They did not like Nancy even mentioned it a few times, going, maybe we shouldn't do this in front of the cameras. They're not used to somebody who just says what they think and says it for the whole, you know, who cares? He's not poll tested, it's not focus grouped, it's just this is what he thinks. And Nancy Pelosi, when you hear her first speak in this clip, Donald Trump says, you want to say something, Nancy? And they think this is just, you know, they're each going to say a couple of things and then the cameras are going to leave and then they'll get down to business. It evolved from there and went on. But it's kind of funny because Nancy Pelosi immediately went into a prepared statement, an absolutely 100% prepared canned statement that she had memorized. You can hear it in her voice. Listen.
Nancy, would you like to say something?
Well, thank you, Mr. President, for the opportunity to meet with you so that we can work together in a bipartisan way to meet the needs of the American people. I think the American people recognize that we must keep government open, that a shutdown is not worth anything, and that you should not have a Trump shutdown. You have them at the White House, a Trump shutdown.
You can tell it was planned, but we should not have a Trump shutdown. They've already labeled it. Remember the last shutdown was the Schumer shutdown, and that didn't work out very well for Democrats, and they quickly scrambled to reopen government because they were getting hammered in the polls. So this time Democrats are trying to get out in front of it, saying this is a Trump shutdown, and the president catches it there. Again, these people are talking about refusing to spend $5 billion to secure parts of our southern border, which are overrun with illegal immigrants and most of the drug traffic that happens in this country. Most of the illegal drugs that come into this country come in up through Mexico. Why? Because if they came in through a port, there's a good chance they'd be caught. If they flew in through an airport and stuffed it inside a suitcase or inside statues or something, there's a good chance they'd be caught. But the southern border is incredibly porous. So you can just march it across with some drug mules and get it into the country in mass quantities. So, you know, $5 billion, these Democrats have drawn the line in the sand saying, we will not fund this no matter what. We support border security. We just don't want to do anything that would secure the border. That's essentially their argument. It's garbage. And they're perfectly willing to spend billions, hundreds of billions of dollars on all sorts of scams and all sorts of government programs. But when it comes to securing the southern border, absolutely not. And they've already got a ready-made term, Trump shutdown. Later on, Trump owns it. I think this is a winning issue for the president. I think the American people, this is Trump at his best in these exchanges that you're going to hear, because there is no filter. There is no awkward reading. It's not a deep dive into policy. It's straight up principle. We need to secure the border, period. End of story. And the Democrats don't know how to deal with somebody who is speaking plainly to them. The American people hear this, and they hear legalese, jingos, and sort of canned talking points from the Democrats. And they hear the president of the United States, I don't care. I want to secure the border. I want to make sure this country is safe. The American people can easily understand that. Here's the next clip.
You have the White House, you have the Senate, you have the House of Representatives, you have the votes. You should pass it.
No, we
right
don't
now.
Have the votes, Nancy, because in the Senate we need 60 votes.
No, but in the House,
and we don't
you
have.
Could bring it up right now.
Yeah, but
today.
I can't, excuse me, but I can't get it passed in the House if it's not going to pass in the Senate. I don't want to waste time.
Well, the fact is, you can get it started that way.
The House we can get passed very easily,
okay,
and we
do.
But the problem is the Senate, because we need 10 Democrats to vote,
yeah,
and
that's
they
not
won't
the
vote.
Point, Mr. President.
Nancy doesn't seem, this is part of the duplicity of the Democrats here. They're saying, well, why don't you pass something in the House? You could pass something in the House, but there are very few legislative days left in this Congress. Why waste time debating and passing legislation that's just going to die in the Senate? Without 10 Democrats in the Senate, or I guess 9 Democrats in the Senate, if all the Republicans went with it, but Jeff Flake, who the hell knows? That guy's a flake, and he'd probably vote against it just because he's a jerk. So without the votes of Democrats in the Senate, to cloture, they will filibuster it. It doesn't go anywhere. There are other things that Congress has to do by the end of the year. So why waste time in the House? Nancy knows this. She knows it's not going anywhere in the Senate without Democrat votes, but she's pretending, no, no, no. You control the House, you control the Senate, you control the White House. Do this. It's a garbage argument that only works on the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortezes of the world, people who don't understand civics, who don't understand how Congress works. And she's counting on most of her supporters, which is probably true, not knowing how government actually works. The filibuster allows the Democrats to lie like this. I'm not opposed to the filibuster because I know that someday Republicans are again going to be in the minority. And I also don't want this. If we get rid of the filibuster, then laws, massive laws, can be changed and repealed at whim based on shifting party control in the Congress. And that would just be a disaster. I like the fact that the Senate, I wish we'd get rid of the 17th Amendment and get rid of direct election of senators again, which I've talked about in the past, but that's again another story. Nancy Pelosi knows she's lying. And the president is calling her out on it. And she's not used to this because normally politicians of different parties, except on a debate stage, do not engage like this in front of the media, in front of cameras, in front of prying eyes. They do all their dirty dealings behind closed doors, and then they go out and they put their spin on it at the press conference afterwards. But this time the president allowed the media to stay, thereby allowing we the people to watch our government at work or not at work, depending on how you want to put it. There's more.
The point is that there are equities to be weighed, and we're here to have a conversation in
Correct.
A prayerful way, so I don't think we should have a debate Correct. In front of the press on this, but the fact is the Senate, the House Republicans could bring up this bill if they had the votes immediately and set the tone for what you want.
If we thought we were going to get it passed in the Senate, Nancy, we would do it immediately. We'd get it passed very easily in the House.
No, that's
we
not
would get it, Nancy, I'd have it passed in 2 seconds. It doesn't matter, though, because we can't get it passed in the Senate because we need 10 Democrat votes.
Well,
that's the problem.
Again, let us have our conversation, then
that's
we can
right.
meet with the press again.
Nancy Pelosi is not happy that the media is watching this. Nancy Pelosi is wildly uncomfortable being challenged in front of cameras. She's not used to being challenged in front of cameras. It doesn't happen to Nancy Pelosi. She very deliberately avoids situations where she is challenged in front of cameras. because, as I pointed out, her arguments are garbage. Her arguments are weak. She's used to having conversations like this in private, probably much more cordial, much more free, and then going out and saying, we had a decent dialogue and we're going to move forward, but it is immoral to build a wall. Walls are immoral. And then she'll go back to her gated community with her security detail. Basically, do as I say, not as I do, from Nancy Pelosi. There's always more.
We do not want to shut down the government. You have called 20 times to shut down the government. You say, I want to shut down the government. We don't. We want to come to an agreement. If we can't come to an agreement, we have solutions that will pass the House and Senate right now and will not shut down the government. And that's what we're urging you to do. Not threaten to shut down the government because you, let me just finish, because you can't get your way.
Ah, Chuck Schumer, you will not find any audio of the President of the United States saying, I want to shut down the government, because he's never said it. He said he's willing to shut down the government if they don't build a wall, if they don't secure the border. Not, I want to shut down the government. He said he's willing to. There's a huge, huge difference. Again, Chuck Schumer is not used to being challenged. He's slightly more used to it than Nancy Pelosi, because the New York media is a little more aggressive, not more challenging, but certainly more aggressive. And it's two New Yorkers talking. They know how to talk to each other. This is how New Yorkers talk to each other. But I love that. You said you want to shut down the government. I want to shut down the government. Where are the media fact checkers on this one, on this claim? Are there any fact checkers? Can anybody find any evidence? Donald Trump saying, I want to shut down, I can't wait to shut down the government. That's what Chuck Schumer is saying. That is false. The president is drawing a line in the sand, has drawn a line in the sand. Whether he holds it or not, I don't know. If you remember the last time there was a budget battle last year, the president signed the budget. It was an enormous budget. And he said immediately this was a mistake. There was no money in it for the border wall. And he said, I'm never doing this again. Next time, there's going to be money in there for the wall or I won't sign it. He's staying true to his word. Chuck Schumer in 2006 voted for a border wall. Chuck Schumer back in the early 2000s was in favor of a border wall. Chuck Schumer has changed. Donald Trump has not changed. But Chuck Schumer will not be called out for that change. None of the Democrats. I played you the audio. Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, Chuck Schumer. You've heard it all. Will not be called out for having changed their minds, their positions. I don't think they changed their minds. I think they made new political calculations is what they did. But there's no calls for hypocrisy. There's no fact-checking of these lies that they're spewing. They'll fact check the hell out of Donald Trump, and I guarantee you today in the New York Times and or the Washington Post and on cable news, there will be so-called fact checks of the things the president said in this press conference. There'll be none of the Democrats. Again, we have more.
Let's call a halt to this. We've come in here as the first branch of government. Article 1, the legislative branch. We're coming in good faith to negotiate with you about how we can keep the government
open. We're going to keep it open if we have border security. If we don't have border security, Chuck, we're not going to keep it open.
I love this. Let's call an end to this. She wants the cameras out of the room desperately. We come in here in good faith to negotiate. Well, there's one thing that the President of the United States wants, and that is $5 billion for a border wall. Or toward a border wall, to put up sections, big sections of a border wall. They have come in, the Democrats have come in and said, we will not give you anything for that. Nothing. So how do you negotiate with that? Where do you start negotiating with this? Where's the negotiation option from the Democrats? Where are they willing to come in? They're going to come in and they say, we wanted sweet, nourishing dreamers to be granted citizenship. And then their parents, so they're not deported as well. And then, of course, everybody else, they always want everything, everything, everything. And they're willing to give nothing, nothing whatsoever. $5 billion is not that much money in the grand scheme of government. It is less than one half of one day's spending by the federal government, and they will not budge an inch, but they say they're there to negotiate. That's like sitting down and saying, well, let's negotiate. I offer you nothing and demand everything I want back. And that is my final offer. Okay. How do you negotiate with that? It's like negotiating with a terrorist. How do you negotiate with a terrorist? You sit across from them and they say, well, what do you want? Or you say, what do you want? And they say, I want you dead. Okay, so where's the middle ground on that? Right from the start, I want you dead. Well, you can't kill me, but you can maim me. You can take an arm, or you can take a leg. You can't negotiate with somebody who has said absolutely 100% no to your demand, to your request, to what you want. There is no middle ground. The Democrats know this, and that's why they don't want the cameras in there capturing it, because the video and the audio demonstrates that fact to the American people, and they don't want us to see it.
You know what? We need border security. That's what we're going to be talking about, border security. If we don't have border security, we'll shut down the government. This country needs border security. The wall is a part of border security. Let's have a talk. We're going to get the wall built.
We're going to get the wall built. Let's have border security. Democrats say they're all for border security, but they don't want a wall. Nancy Pelosi last week called a wall immoral. So then how do you get border security? Do you hire a hundred million border patrol agents to turn the border into a linking of arms, a hands across America, a game of Red Rover with illegals that come across? What is their answer? They don't really have one. They're not really for border security. They want open borders. Everything that they do is to favor illegal aliens over over American citizens. They view them as future potential voters. And more importantly, they're trying to appeal based on their identity politics to Hispanics already in this country, who they've tried to condition to believe that you should only identify with and only care about people who look like you, people with a common heritage of yours, which is incredibly racist. This pandering that they have been engaging in is the same pandering they have been engaging in with every other ethnicity in this country, particularly the black vote. They're getting 90% of the black vote or more, pandering to them. How's that working out? It's not working out great. But now Hispanics have passed blacks as the number one minority, most populous minority in this country. So they're trying to take that model that worked so successfully in the past and apply it to Hispanics. Only identify with somebody of your race. That's the way to do it. Will it work? I don't know. I hope not, because it's a really screwed up anti-American way to view life. I can only be represented by people who look like me, by people who act like me. We heard this the other day on the show we did about the race and CNN and MSNBC and the anchors being complete and total racist. Just, should you be running for president as a white guy? Let's be honest. We had enough of you whitey. Move along. That's the Democratic mindset, and that's why they are drawing such a hard line against having any kind of border security. Now it gets interesting in the audio. Listen to this.
One thing I think we can agree on is we shouldn't shut down the government over a dispute. And you want to shut it down. You keep talking about it.
The last time, Chuck, you shut it down.
No.
And then you opened it up very quickly. And
20 times.
I don't want to do what you did.
20 times, Chuck, you have called for, I will shut down the government if I don't get my wool. None of us have
you
said.
You want to know something?
You've said
it. Okay, you want to put that
you
on my...
You said it.
I'll take it.
Okay, good.
You know what I'll say? Yes. If we don't get what we want, one way or the other, whether it's through you, through a military, through anything you want to call, I will shut down the government.
Okay.
The gauntlet has been officially thrown. The president is standing. He ran on this. He was elected in large part because of this. The people who voted for him voted for a wall, and he's standing up for it. When was the last time you remember a politician? Something plain as day. You know, it's yes or no. It's happening or it's not. The president is standing up and saying, no, this is happening. I will shut down the government. You can blame me for it all you want. I don't care. And frankly, in politics, having a politician, an elected official, willing to stand up and say, no, I don't care, this is what I said I'm going to do, and this is what I'm going to do, damn it, is incredibly refreshing. What, no matter, it's weird to see, because you don't see this very often. They say, well, we've got to, they usually put vague ideas out there. A normal politician would have just talked about border security and not a specific wall. Then the Democrats would have groused about that, and maybe they would have come up with a small amount of money to say, all right, now we use this money to secure the border, and they'll spend it in Kansas and Colorado on random things as part of ICE or Department of Homeland Security's budget, and say, well, we did spend this much money on this thing, and they just blow smoke up your butt. The president of the United States is putting a stop to that right there. No, we're not going to take half measures. We're not going to play the typical games that you guys play. You want to shut down the government over this? Fine. And frankly, would you miss the government? If you're being honest with yourself, of course you wouldn't. One last clip here.
I am proud to shut down the government for border security, Chuck, because the people of this country don't want criminals and people that have lots of problems and drugs pouring into our country. So I will take the mantle. I will be the one to shut it down. I'm not going to blame you for it. The last time you shut it down, it didn't work. I will take the mantle of shutting down. And I'm going to shut it down for border security.
But we believe you shouldn't shut it down.
President right there laying it down, and Chuck Schumer and I, but we believe you shouldn't shut it down. Then come through on border security. Fund $5 billion for the wall, and then it won't be shut down. I think this plays well with the American people. You don't often hear anybody in elected office talk this plainly and stand on principle like this. I have a lot of problems with Donald Trump and what he's done and what he's tried to do, but on this one, I'm right there with him. I think far too many politicians compromise and call it a victory. A tie is not a victory. A loss where you kind of get something, a 7-6 loss is not a victory because you scored 6 points. No. The president has drawn a line, and I, for one, like it a lot. Another thing I like a lot, ladies and gentlemen, is this new poll. It's kind of hilarious. It's a MoveOn.org 2020 president poll for the Democrats, of course. MoveOn.org is a big left-wing organization formed in the late 90s to tell us to move on from Bill Clinton's affairs. Now they've moved on to raking in a whole bunch of money and selling email lists for more money. They asked a whole bunch of liberals who they thought should be, who they support for the Democratic nomination for 2020. And it's being reported in a way that's really dishonest. The headline on NBC News, for example, of course, this is NBC News, so what do you expect? The headline is, Beto O'Rourke narrowly tops wide open move on 2020 presidential straw poll. Biden is runner up. And you think, well, Beto O'Rourke, first of all, please nominate Beto O'Rourke. He lost in Texas. He lost his election. Please nominate that man. But then you go down to the results. Now, here's the order of finish. Beto O'Rourke at 15.6%. Joe Biden at 14.9%. Bernie Sanders at 13.1%, which is kind of shocking considering Move On endorsed Bernie in the past, and he overwhelmingly got votes in the primaries from Move On supporters. Then it's Kamala Harris at 10%, who's done absolutely nothing in the Senate and has her own Me Too problems with a former close staffer settling a sexual harassment claim with state money on her watch, and she claims she didn't know anything about it. Elizabeth Warren, Pocahontas at 6.4%, then Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown at 2.9%, and then Amy Klobuchar, Michael Bloomberg, and Cory Booker all floating in the 2% range. But you look and you say, okay, well, you do the math in your head. You shouldn't, don't worry. You come up short of 100%. And you say, wait a second, the top vote getter was 15.6%, and you didn't list that many names. So how do you get to, well, actually, contrary to the headline, the real winner of this straw poll was somebody else. I'm not kidding. It's not in the headline. It should be, you know, Democrats the wide open thing, Democrats still looking for somebody to swoop in, that would be a true headline. Not Beto O'Rourke is the Democrat's choice. Because somebody else they didn't know or other got 28.8% of the votes in this poll. So the Democrats have no idea who they want. There is nobody. To say that Beto O'Rourke is he's the prohibitive favorite at this point because of this poll is garbage. To put that in a headline is fake news. It's garbage. But the media absolutely love this guy because he skateboards and he reminds them of JFK. But of course, JFK would not be allowed in today's Democrat Party. Just kind of funny that the most popular Democrat running for president in 2020 so far is somebody else. Now, that'll change, but right now the smart money is on somebody else. And every sense of that term, because you look at these candidates, the people that do register, and you think, what a weak field. They've got a guy who lost a Senate race, a former vice president who's approaching 75, 80 years old, and then crazy Doc Brown from the Back to the Future movies and Bernie Sanders, who couldn't even beat Hillary. And hell, Donald Trump beat Hillary. So, yeah, good luck, Democrats. I'm sure they'll come up with somebody. And I suspect it will, in fact, be somebody else. Couple things here before we get into Time's Person of the Year. I want to spend some time on that because of the absurdity of what they chose and why they chose it. But there's an op-ed, the Daily Mail, the UK Daily Mail, which is, I think, the world's most popular website. That's not porn. Maybe it is, even including porn. I don't know. Piers Morgan writes a column over there. This isn't the craziest. I read this at first, and I thought, this is a crazy idea. This is stupid. This is just a glory hound trying to get attention. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, you know what? Maybe this kind of makes sense. In his column yesterday, Piers Morgan, the headline says it all. You've hired me before, Mr. President, so hire me again. I'm the one person whose reputation can't be tarnished by becoming your chief of staff, and I'm perfectly qualified for the job. I read that, geez, he's just trying to get attention, Piers Morgan is. He's just being ridiculous. But the more you think about it, Piers Morgan was on The Apprentice. I think he might have won. He hates Omarosa. If he didn't win, he was runner-up. He hates Omarosa. He recognized her for the scumbag that she was right away. And there's some truth to this. Piers Morgan, while I disagree with him vehemently on a lot of issues, particularly guns, the idea of him as chief of staff isn't all that crazy. Because whoever takes the job of chief of staff, thanks to the rabid, rancid, rotting media that we have, is going to be, they're going to get a colonoscopy from the media. It's going to be ridiculous. And if they have absolutely anything in their past, I mean, hell, the Heisman Trophy winner had tweets dredged up from when he was 14 years old this week, the day he won the Heisman Trophy. That's how sick the liberal media is. So the idea of somebody who owns their mistakes and is pretty unapologetic about it is a good one. Piers Morgan doesn't really need to worry about what comes next. If you get some 40-year-old with a couple of kids and a wife to be chief of staff, there's a possibility that they're going to be subpoenaed 10,000 times by Capitol Hill, by congressional Democrats. They may end up spending their entire salary on lawyers, because Democrats will just manufacture things to investigate them about. So there's a lot of hesitancy about taking this job because it comes with a lot of baggage. That's how successfully the media and the Democrats have lied about this Russian collusion crap. So there are a lot of people who could do this job who probably don't want this job because they can't afford to be harassed by our government for serving a president of the United States. Piers Morgan has no problem with that. Piers Morgan is a wealthy guy. Piers Morgan doesn't seem to be hiding too much about his life and never really has. And if you're worried about his liberal policy ideas, he's all over the map, but particularly on guns, the final arbiter is the President of the United States. When I worked in the Senate, I was a press secretary. I was also, I'd come over from the Heritage Foundation, where I was a health policy analyst. There was really nobody on staff who knew health policy, so certainly not as well as I did. It was in somebody's portfolio, but it was like issue number 7 because of committee assignments. You're getting into minutia here. It doesn't really matter. So I kind of did both. Whenever there was a health care issue, I briefed the senator on it. And I tried to influence him on a wide range. I had a lot of interaction with Conrad Burns. He was an open door senator. If his door was open and he was in there, anybody could go in there. Other senators, depending on the senator and their staff and how busy they are or just their personalities, you weren't allowed to talk to the senator. You certainly couldn't just walk into their office without permission. The gatekeeper, the scheduler, the secretary outside would stop you and say, "Well, he can't see you right now." The chief of staff would stop you. Conrad Burns didn't have that. You could walk in and talk to him about anything. And I talked to him about a great many things before votes were cast. I tried to make him more conservative. I tried to win arguments. Sometimes I was more successful than others. But I know, I'll never betray which ones and why and how. I knew as part of the job that once the decision was made, it was my job to sell it, whether I liked the decision or not. He was the one who was elected. He was the senator. I was the press secretary. He made the ultimate decision. Up until the point that he made that decision, he was kind enough to his staff to listen to anybody on it, hear us out, and open-minded enough to possibly be swayed on it. But once the decision was made, I had to go sell it, whether I thought it was a good one or not. The same thing for chief of staff to the President of the United States. Of course, you'd have input. You'd have influence. A lot of influence. But at the end of the day, when the decision is made by the President of the United States, that's the decision, no matter what your thoughts or feelings were on it. Game over at that point, and it's your job to implement it. So I think Piers Morgan, if he's willing to do that, if he understands that, could be a decent chief of staff. He might be the chief of staff that the president needs. You never know. And also, you know, this is not a good day. It takes a lot to make Stormy Daniels gag. Just let that sit there for a second. But yesterday she had a reason to gag. No, it wasn't on the set of her new movie, although who knows where she got this news. The federal judge in the defamation suit that she and her lawyer, Michael Avenatti, filed against the president that was summarily thrown out and she was ordered to pay President Trump's legal fees, well, he put a dollar amount on it. Now Stormy Daniels is ordered to pay Donald Trump and pay his lawyers $293,052.33. That seems very, very, that it doesn't seem, it is very, very precise, a very exact number. But I love this. Michael Avenatti allegedly filed this suit against Stormy Daniels' wishes and is now on the defense. It's kind of funny. And you can tell that he knows he's screwed because these two have had a bit of a public feud over this lawsuit and a bunch of other things, like where all the money that was raised went, because Stormy doesn't know what happened to that money, and Michael says, "It's in my pocket, because that's what we agreed upon." So Michael Avenatti took to his Twitter account and started talking about how, you know, it doesn't matter. This is going to be dwarfed, this amount. We're going to win $1.5 million easily in our non-disclosure agreement lawsuit against the president, so this doesn't really even matter. Well, I think it does matter. I think Stormy Daniels is probably pretty pissed off that she's got to plunk down $300,000 on the prospect of the guy who advised her to sue in the first place and lost that $300,000 for her saying, "We're going to win $1.5 million. Because even if she were to win $1.5 million, which I highly doubt, she's only going to get $1.2 million now. And then you take out the attorney's fees from that and all of her expenses and the taxes and everything. And suddenly she's not ending up with all that much money, which, you know, losing $300,000 of anything she ends up winning, if anything, has got to piss her off. She's worked very hard to be where she is. She's spent a lot of time on her. Never mind. I'm not going to say it. Okay, finally today, Time magazine has now finally named their person of the year, and I was wrong. I thought it would be separated families. I thought they would go after the president and try and advance the liberal agenda that way, but they went a different direction to go after the president and advance the liberal agenda. They went with Jamal Khashoggi and the Guardians, which is one of the lowest-selling Marvel comic books of all time. It really is just a pathetic choice. It's a self-aggrandizing choice. Journalism is important, but journalism isn't done anymore, and that's a bigger problem. If you want to talk about journalism as 2018 being the year, or the year in journalism, think of it as a year that journalism got at least a couple of extra nails in their coffin. Not these brave truth tellers. The people that they are naming as person of the year are the exception in journalism, not the rule. And the very rare exception of the ones who actually do anything remotely close to journalism. But Jamal Khashoggi was not a journalist. He was an opinion columnist for the Washington Post. He was an apologist for the Muslim Brotherhood. And yes, he should not have been killed by Saudi Arabia. But it is irrelevant to the grand scheme of things. I guarantee you've never heard of this guy before he was killed. Yet somehow, because he can be used as a weapon against the President of the United States, it is the most important thing in the world. They announced Jamal Khashoggi, Maria Ressa, Wa Loni, Kiwa So O, I'm butchering these names, but there's nothing I can do about it, and the Capital Gazette in Annapolis, Maryland, as Person of the Year or Persons of the Year. And you think Capital Gazette of Annapolis, Maryland, a local newspaper, you've likely forgotten that a lunatic went into the Capital Gazette and murdered a bunch of people. Wasn't that long ago, but hey, you've got no reason to remember it unless you knew somebody involved. How that qualifies them, how that is relevant, this was not somebody, the media tried to portray it as, well, this is, Donald Trump was clearly inspiring this. This is a result of the rhetoric of the President of the United States saying fake news. But then it turns out that the guy who did it, the lunatic monster who did it, had a long history of threatening the newspaper, had a long history of disputes with the newspaper that predated anybody hearing of Donald Trump running for president. But the media is not one to let the facts stand in the way of a good story. This is a self-congratulatory pick. It's a testament to the fact that they simply didn't want to pick Donald Trump. It doesn't matter if you like Donald Trump or not. There was nobody who had more impact on the world and the news in 2018, and it sure as hell wasn't journalists, if there was. Time magazine writes, for all the insults hurled by the president at the press, rhetoric which has been deployed by dangerous actors around the world. Yes, Donald, I love how they portray the rest of the world as it was a haven for free expression and a free press before Donald Trump came along and called Jim Acosta a piece of crap and said that CNN is fake news. Then suddenly these despots who had tolerated dissent, which they didn't, tolerated dissent, suddenly said, hey, now we've got the President of the United States who hates the press. Let's go to town, ladies and gentlemen. Now we can finally seek our revenge against journalists. It's garbage. This is fantasy land. They know better. They're counting on the audience not knowing any better. And the people who read Time magazine likely don't know any better. Anyway, it continues. Despite the rhetoric which has been deployed by dangerous actors around the world, the U.S. remains a beacon for truth and free expression. Now, how is that possible? How can the U.S. remain a beacon for truth and free expression if you watch MSNBC, CNN, read Time magazine or Newsweek, the New York Times, the Washington Post, pretty much every newspaper in the country, and you see that this is a huge assault on the freedom of the press, and that Donald Trump is a despot. He is a totalitarian. How can there be truth and free expression in a totalitarian dictatorship? Of course, there can't be. But again, they're not letting the facts stand in the way of a good narrative. This is a nation where, as we saw this year, news organizations can sue the White House and win, even at the hands of a judge appointed by that very White House. They're talking about Jim Acosta there. You know he's getting aroused when he read this part of the article. One of the people who sought refuge in these freedoms was Jamal Khashoggi, the most visible representative of this harrowing year for truth. Suddenly, Jamal Khashoggi is the ultimate truth teller. He retroactively is, he'll probably win a Pulitzer for something. He'll likely win a whole bunch of other awards posthumously, and they'll bring his children up on stage to receive them. And there will be rounds of criticism of Donald Trump for saying fake news. But Jamal Khashoggi, again, is somebody you've never heard of until he was killed. And you wouldn't have heard of him if he had any other job. And you wouldn't have heard of him if Donald Trump weren't president. This marks the first year Time has named someone who is no longer alive a person of the year. But it is also rare that a person's influence grows so immensely in death. What influence? Can you tell me? Do you know, if you know somebody who is now the biggest Jamal Khashoggi fan in the world since his murder, I would love to hear about it. If you suddenly go, oh, my, I read his words, and boy, they moved me. Or if you know anybody, you or anybody had ever heard of this guy before he was murdered, I would love to hear it. Email me, Derek@DailyCaller.com. I'll read it on the air. But it is also rare that a directed by a killer whose motives was control of information, as Khashoggi's fellow Washington Post columnist David Ignatius noted, the murder has prompted a global reassessment of Saudi Arabia's crown prince, who the CIA assessment concluded likely ordered the killing and the devastating war he was waging in Yemen. You're really sitting around, again, rethinking everything. Saudi Arabia is far more important than Jamal Khashoggi. They should not have murdered him. There should be some consequences, minor, handled behind the scene, or something public that is more symbolism over substance. But quite frankly, our relationship with Saudi Arabia is far more important than Jamal Khashoggi. He was not an American. He was living here under a special visa that allowed him to work. He was not even a legal permanent resident of the United States. This murder did not happen in the United States. It happened over in Turkey. So, again, it had nothing to do with the United States except for the fact that he had an occasional byline at the Washington Post. And that's it. That is it. But he was a useful foil to attack the president of the United States. Oh, yes, the killer, his motive was to control the control of information. Well, maybe he was murdered because he was a dick. Who knows? We don't actually know why he was murdered. He was a critic of the Saudi regime. But radical Islamists in the Muslim Brotherhood don't like the Saudi regime. They don't like the crown prince in Saudi Arabia. He was the one, certainly not a good guy, not saying anybody involved here is a good guy, but the crown prince had instituted some reforms that allowed women to leave their homes without a male family member with them, allowed women to drive for the first time. These were major steps. If it weren't for the murder of Khashoggi and, well, if not even the murder, if it weren't for the useful nature of the murder of Khashoggi to the left-wing agenda against the president of the United States, Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, would still be celebrated as some kind of progressive hero. But because they can use this murder as a weapon against the president, they throw all that aside. They just ignore it. Now the other people. Reza is the founder and editor of a Philippine news site, Rappler, known for its fearless reporting on President Rodrigo Duterte's propaganda machine and extrajudicial killings. In return, she faced a barrage of government lawsuits aimed at the site. These are some of the other people, by the way, who are part of The Guardians. In return, she faced a barrage of government lawsuits aimed at the site and violent hate messages on social media. At one point, 90 of them an hour. Again, horrible. And I wouldn't recommend going to the Philippines. But listen to that thing. She reported, and she faced the wrath of government in the form of lawsuits aimed at her website and violent hate messages on social media. Hell, by that unit of measure, every conservative should be person of the year on social media, because we received nasty messages, violent hate messages. There is no such, anyway, words are not violence. But we receive horrible messages constantly. Michelle Malkin should be the person of the year. She, I bet, receives more, her and Ann Coulter receive more violent threats, and Dana Loesch, more violent threats than just about anybody on social media, because they exist wrong. Now, quote, now is certainly not the time to be afraid, she said on December 3rd, after turning herself in and posting bail on tax fraud charges that would carry jail sentences of up to 10 years, charges widely viewed as an effort to stifle her work. Maybe they are, or maybe she evaded taxes. She turned herself in and was released on bail. Again, Duterte, or however you pronounce it, there's so many different ways to pronounce these names, is not a good dude. But this woman is not being oppressed. She seems to have been afforded her due process rights. She's free on bail, for God's sakes. Now, if she'd have been arrested and thrown in prison and then threw away the key, then absolutely, positively. But that's not what they're reporting. It continues. The repercussions aren't always from above. The gunman at the Capitol Gazette allegedly was a local man aggrieved years after the fact that the paper's reporting had brought his harassment of a woman out of the shadows. What do you mean, allegedly? We know this to be true. The massacre he perpetrated made America the fourth deadliest country in the world to be a journalist this year. But while the loss was immense and intensely personal that day, the staff at one of the nation's oldest news outlets did what it had done since before the American Revolution. They put out a paper. You know, I don't know how that's superhuman, but hey, whatever. If that's how you choose to deal with grief, who am I to judge? The press always has and always will commit errors of judgment, of omission, of accuracy. What? How can that possibly be? Why is it that all of them in the Trump administration are in one direction? There has never been a story that has been corrected or retracted in the Trump administration that initially made the Trump administration look good, and then upon further review they said, oops, we really screwed up. We got this story wrong. It's always been stories that attack the Trump administration that make the Trump administration look bad, and then later they say, wait a second, we finally did some basic fact-checking journalism and we discovered that we were completely wrong on this thing. And yet, what it does is fundamental. No, what it's supposed to do is fundamental. What it does is activism. Says Andrea Chambly, whose husband John McNamara was one of the five Capitol Gazette staffers killed, quote, a lot of people don't understand how important what goes on in their community is to them and how it affects their quality of life until it's gone, end quote. For taking risks in pursuit, this is where they really, you can trumpets flare. for taking risks in pursuit of greater truths, for the imperfect but essential quest for facts that are central to civil discourse, for speaking up and speaking out, the guardians, Jamal Khashoggi, Wa Lone, and Kiwa So-O, Maria Reza, and the Capital Gazette of Annapolis, Maryland, are Times Person of the Year. That was the editor's note, a note from the editor-in-chief of why the Guardians are the Person of the Year. I can put it in much easier terms. Journalists are liberal. Journalists have really, really low favorability ratings with the American public because we've started to pick up on the lies on a daily basis and the omission, thanks to alternative streams of information. They just leave things out. They ignore large swaths of a story completely and think that everything is fine. They create their own fantasy world. And journalists hate that. Liberal media hates the fact that you are able to get more information than they want you to have. So they are celebrating people who fit the liberal narrative. There is not one single conservative journalist out there. There is not one, no conservative was really even considered to be Times Person of the Year. The closest was Donald Trump. He's more of a populist than a conservative. Everybody else pretty much was a liberal activist or a liberal person. And they chose, of course, the one. Donald Trump came in second, so they put number one as the weapon used to attack number two. And that's appropriate. Number two is what this all is. You read this crap and you really think these people love themselves. How can they get through any door with egos this size? Journalism used to be important. Journalism should be important. But you can read a newspaper and not learn anything. You can watch a cable news network and not read anything. You can read an article from the editor-in-chief of Time magazine and not learn anything except a liberal political agenda item. I wish journalists practiced fearless journalism. I wish journalists practiced agendaless journalism. They don't. In this country, there is no fear because no matter what the President of the United States says, these people know that they are not being threatened. For all his self-aggrandizement, Jim Acosta realizes that no matter what happens, he's still going to have his highly lucrative CNN contract and will get more TV hits, and he's still going to be a blowhard on TV. There's no risk that somebody is going to walk into the White House press briefing room and arrest Jim Acosta and April Ryan and whatever clown happens to be sitting there for the day for MSNBC and throw them in prison and accuse them of crimes against the state. No. What happens is the president and the people at the podium point out how they are wrong, how they lie in some cases, how they make the story about themselves in others. And that's about it. Move on. Keep on trucking. No real consequences. Elsewhere in the world, absolutely. There are people who are risking their lives and their freedom to report on things, but that's not what this is about. They make casual mention of around the world, these people, but throwing in the Capital Gazette is a push for gun control. It has nothing to do with the national discussion. It was a lunatic that they should have had an eye on who had made threats against the paper before, who was not motivated by the President of the United States, but they like to imply that he was. And then they lump them in with this part, just demonstrate just how dangerous journalism is. Yeah, dangerous. Journalism can be dangerous. Any job can be dangerous. Journalism can be important, by the way. It just chooses not to be. It chooses activism over accuracy. And that's a shame. So I would put the death of journalism as Person of the Year of 2018, not journalists themselves, not the guardians. Just the pretentious nature of calling these people the guardians is absurd, but it lets you know what these people really think of themselves. And conversely, by accident, sort of a side effect, it lets you know what these people think of you, too. And I don't mean like Bono and The Edge and Larry Mullen Jr. and Adam Clayton. They always get screwed when you talk about you two. Anyway, that is all the time we have for today. Went a little long today. Sorry about that. I appreciate you listening. Please tell a friend. Help spread the word. Expose them to the podcast. That's the only thing we got going for us is you guys. So I appreciate the hell out of it. And be back here tomorrow for another exciting episode of the Daily Caller Podcast. Have a great one.
I am proud to shut down the government for border security, Chuck, because the people of this country don't want criminals and people that have lots of problems and drugs pouring into our country.